This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
Finding Stuff.
Nymphs.
James Fielder.
And the Vampire Rampage of Mikhail Kasparek.
Big news from Mission Control. If you missed out the first time, don't panic. The wait is over. The Catstronauts board game is finally back in stock at Atlas Games.
That's right. Catstronauts sold out almost immediately on release, but the reprint has officially landed. Now you can finally bring the kitty crew home to your tabletop.
And just in time, too, because things are getting interesting on the International Space Station.
Giant laser pointers in space and a live stream of nose boops? What's not to like? Let's check out how the Catstronauts are doing up there.
Oh man, there goes Waffles the pilot. He's off to see how many kibble bits can achieve orbit around his belly. A pioneer in snackodynamics, that cat.
Careful, Waffles. If the other Catstronauts catch you clogging the air filters with crumbs again, it's back to litter box duty for you.
Look at them working together. Waffles is keeping the station steady. Pom Pom is swatting at fasteners like feather toys. And Major Meowser is... napping on the instructions.
Teamwork at its finest. You can lead this kitty crew yourself in the official Catstronauts board game.
It's a cooperative challenge featuring pawsome art by the comics creator Drew Brockington, and it's perfect for gamers of all ages.
But remember, the first printing disappeared at light speed. Don't let this reprint of Catstronauts slip through your claws.
Secure your copy today at atlas-games.com/catstronauts. That's atlas-games.com/catstronauts. The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, or is that dried salt herring? Welcome us once more to the windswept battlements of Elsinore Castle. It was herring, darn it, where we are huddled around and in front of Hamlet's GM screen, celebrating once more Robin's new forthcoming book on the art of story beat mapping in your very own campaign. And now, as we move through that campaign, through that tabletop adventure, we are at Finding Stuff. And Robin, I have a million questions about Finding Stuff. Well, actually, I have one question about Finding Stuff, which is, in story beat terms, do we notice a difference between Gumshoe, where you automatically find the stuff and then move triumphantly forward into the story, or overconfidently forward into danger, as befits you, and other, dare I say, lesser systems where you might not find the stuff and therefore your adventure is stuff deprived?
Right. So in an ordinary situation where you're finding stuff, let's start with just a regular success. There is the question, let's say we've got some F20 characters, they're entering the room, and one of the players says, what's in the room? So that's a question. Question beats point the arrow down because they introduce uncertainty. There's a tension to that. What's in the room is not the strongest, most suspenseful question, but it's a question. And so that points the arrow down. And then when the GM says, roll to find stuff, that also introduces suspense because there's the possibility of failure. And this is what the right people who like about this way of doing it like about it, is that one beat where you enjoy the possibility of failure. And if they then roll successfully, they especially enjoy the upbeat that follows when they succeed.
Right, because it feels kind of earned in a way.
Yeah.
Even though it isn't.
Yeah, but it's a down and an up and it cancels out.
Right.
So the GM then says, oh, you find a secret panel. And that's exciting. And so you go, oh, I push open the secret panel. And the GM says, oh, it contains some coins, a glowing golden skull. There you go. That's great. So everything's going well because you made your roll. You succeeded. And so then another character can introduce a question. It's like, what do I know about the golden skull? And GM can throw in some information, a reveal beat. Then another character can ask another question. Are there arcane energies? You can supply that answer, which relieves the tension. And yes, there are strong energies. And so that character can then sort of revel in discovering that and what they're going to do with it. So on a success, yeah, you're doing great. You're doing
everything
fine.
Is bright. Couldn't
everything
be better.
Is bright. If you just automatically succeed, as you do in Gumshoe, you also get all of that excitement, except for those two beats that cancel each other out. The issue, of course, is when you fail. And so you ask what's in the room. The GM asks you to roll. So that's a question, a downbeat. The GM says roll. That's a downbeat. And then you fail your roll. That's a third downbeat in a row. And then the GM just has to say, nothing hidden that you can see. And that's another downbeat because you're either, at best, it's a lateral beat where you legitimately think, oh, well, I guess there's nothing here. But you kind of suspect, since you failed your roll, that there could have been something there.
Or it's a series of lateral beats where they attack all the walls with axes.
Yes, exactly. But since they failed, you're not going to let them have that thing, right? And so,
right.
So this sequence of failure is downbeat, 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 lateral beat, downbeat. So it's not just that nothing has happened, but that you've got five downbeats all clustered together. It's an active drag. It's actively unfun. And you might theoretically think, oh, it would have been better. You know, I'm committed to a system where you roll to get the information, but you didn't get it this time. And so the consequences of failure are not just that you don't get a thing, but that it kills the mood at the table. It's a bummer. It's not just not a thing happening.
And then, again, the instinct amongst some players, and not just young ones, is to then punish the GM by staying in the room well past any possible payoff. Attack the walls with axes. We, you know, do whatever. Attempt to brute force away from the failure that you claimed you wanted in the first place.
Exactly.
And so it's just gone awful.
Aren't you just asking to have succeeded, people?
Right.
Right. And now a more advanced technique, of course, is to, when there's a failure, to try and rescue that, have a more varied series of beats that isn't just a bunch of downbeats by adding a risk that you have then have a chance to survive. So you look in the room, you find the stuff, you miss your roll. But the GM this time says, you found a secret panel, even though you missed your roll. And you are so excited by finding the panel that you've momentarily forgotten that you missed your roll, and then it means you're in trouble. And then the GM says, a Black Widow spider crawls out of the panel and it lands on your hand. And so all of a sudden, you're in danger again. And you make another roll to see if you flick it off. Well, this is the classic kind of roll that Gumshoe also loves, because it is a roll that is interesting whether you succeed or you fail. Either you get the joy of flicking off the spider by making, let's call it a dex roll or an athletics roll or whatever it is. If you make the roll, you're very excited. And then the GM can describe, you know, you're shaking it loose. And then you go back to that whole sequence that you would have had if you succeeded with all of the different varied beats where they find the golden skull and they ask questions about that and so on. Even if, however, our hero fails his dex or athletics check, that's a series of downbeats, but it's exciting, suspenseful downbeats, and with an upbeat where it turns out that the GM says, what do I feel when I've been bitten by the spider? And then the GM can throw in something to keep it interesting. Instead of a lateral beat, you can throw in, oh, it's just a pinprick. And then you momentarily feel, oh, that's great. And then the GM says, followed by intense racking pain.
No!
And so that's a bad thing, but it's an enjoyable bad thing where everybody, in fact, at the table can join in. But that brings more story. So the character can say, oh, somebody do something about this. And then the cleric can jump in, or the person with the anecdote or whatever it is. And then guess what? They have another role, and that can succeed or fail. And either the character is healed or loses some hit points or what have you. But there's all sorts of involvement for other players, and the line is still going up and down rather than just down, down, down. There's a bunch of downs at the beginning, but you asked for that, players, by insisting on a system where you can fail, and you not only failed, but you failed to recover from your failure. So that's entirely on point to have done that. So basically, a success with finding things goes down for a little, then up for a bunch, and then has a little down up at the end. The null failure is basically just all the way down. It's a womp womp. Whereas both the fail forward with an added risk that is averted and a consequence that is suffered, both of those have series of up and down beats. And so that keeps things varied and fun. So there are ways to get around a failed roll by making it more interesting, but that adds more material to what's going on. And after a while, it gets hard to think of more Black Widow spiders for every
right. fail. And that's the real consequence of fail forward is not, you know, necessarily what it does to the story beat, which, as we have just demonstrated, can be fun and happy and exciting. Even if someone is bitten, it's, you know, you went into a dungeon to be bitten by something. That's really why you're there. You're not there for the hunting. But what the real consequence is it drains the GM's creativity, and every Black Widow spider cunningly put into a secret panel, or every ghost of the guy who also got lost exploring this labyrinth or whatever, is another, at best, enjoyable diversion away from the reason you went into the dungeon to rescue the princess or steal the ruby eye of the little god or whatever it is. You're monkeying around with Black Widow spiders and ghosts, and that's really not why you're here. Or it is, at some point, the GM has to roll on the wandering monster table or just say, hey, I guess there's a lot of Black Widow spiders in this dungeon, huh? And then maybe if they're, you know, thinking ahead, they scribble in an Idol of Lolth at the very back end that explains where all these spiders came from. But more like, it's just even the upbeats of a fun spider bite are going to be downed a little bit because it's your third or fifth or ninth spider bite in this dungeon. And just like, you know, the first attack by orcs is fun, the fourth attack by orcs is a little more like, you know, your day job. This is the problem with fail forward, is that it does draw heavily on GM creativity. And a lot of GMs, you know, they've had as big a work day as the players, and maybe they are also coming just so that they can move you through a cool dungeon and roll some dice and chomp something, and not necessarily ready to extrapolate. And often, especially in a F20 circumstance, you're working from a pre-written dungeon, and there's only so much, you know, shimmy or give you can put into it without screwing up the balance or screwing up, you know, the encounter series, especially in modern versions of F20, where it's, nope, five encounters and then you take a rest. Did that Black Widow count as an encounter? The fact that these people are incompetent at finding panels, does this mean that all of our encounters, we're going to have to take a rest in room four? That seems dumb, but there we are.
Right. And often when you talk to people who argue that they want more failure in their games because success is railroady, setting aside even all the different definitions of what railroad means, which is, we've discussed previously, is a meaningless term because it means about 8 to 10 different things. Usually what they say is some variant of, I kind of like it when the GM is put on the back foot. You know, I like to have the GM have to scramble. And they may argue, as you know, well, I kind of like to scramble, but what do you mean? So you want the GM to have to scramble. And that is, as you say, taxing. And if the scenario writer provides a bunch of fail forwards, there's a different tax, which is the length of your adventure, and therefore how much you paid for it, if it's a published adventure, is greater with no more added play value, because, you know, about half the time or more so, the success happens and you don't have to scramble around it. So, in general, the act of finding things and how you treat that differs wildly depending on how much fail forwarding you need, whether you want to just give everybody a break and allow some automatic successes in situations where failure isn't fun. But it does show why that is fun and interesting when it works properly. And that's because when it is working well, it has a nice mix of up and down beats.
And a possible workaround, we are moving away from story beats, but a possible workaround for this can be if you institute a sort of quasi gumshoe where once per level, per adventure, the thief can automatically spot a secret panel, or the ranger can automatically spot animal tracks, or the paladin can automatically detect evil, or whatever it is that gives you the I've found stuff, but it ties it, as a more conventional gumshoe game does, directly into character competence. And that, I argue, as I've always argued, feeding character competence is one of the easiest ways to immediately get player buy-in and therefore player enjoyment. And so, you know, Zero to Hero is a beautiful aspirational experience, but there's a reason that Luke getting stung by the robot happens in a montage, not a lengthily played out segment where he learns to use a lightsaber. So there's a way through it if you still want people to have to roll for some things, but maybe not everything. And this is, you just give them a budget. And if you, one per level is too much, one every two levels, one every three levels, whatever it is, so that the players can decide and make a decision. Is this a role situation? And maybe you've mentioned, yeah, fail forward. So if you fail, you know, you're going to get bit by a spider. Or is this a situation where it is important for us to be really cool and breeze through? And that, I think, might be a bit of a workaround. Not that it's relevant to story beats, but it, I think, plays out in story beats, because doing something cool and then the GM narrating it, or you narrating it to the GM, is an upbeat, right?
Right. And attentive listeners will note that Ken started another segment, and we're going to cut it off ruthlessly in order to move through this exciting commercial message to the planned segment that's right here in our script.
In a hole in the ground, they found a body.
I know! Here we are in Marysher, right in the middle of the beautiful bucolic riding.
So bucolic.
With its neat hedgerows, and picturesque taverns, and delightful crumpet shops, and quaint little village greens.
Can we go back to the crumpets?
Yes, so what did you want to know about them?
I wanted to have some crumpets and shut off the recording.
Okay, let's do that.
Okay, we're back. What were we saying?
Murder!
Murder?
Yes, we've got murder to solve.
In the bucolic riding? Where all the halflings live?
Yes, the halflings. Plus also some boggarts, pukas, and dwarves. But weren't we concerned about something?
Murder?
Yes, murder! Another case in need of sleuthing by a team of amateur detectives.
It would be unthinkable if this wasn't the third murder this week.
Marysher Detective Club is a fantasy mystery-solving RPG.
By the master of fantasy and mystery.
And fantasy mystery.
Gareth Ryder Hanrahan.
Investigate crimes, question eccentric neighbors, stop for tea and cakes, unravel puzzles, and get involved in pedantic arguments about jam.
Wait, what kind of jam?
In the most adorable,
but still murdery,
gumshoe game yet, you gather clues, uncover motives, follow gossip, question suspicious neighbors, stop for lunch, get sidetracked. Remember, you're supposed to be solving a case. Gather some more clues. Question more eccentric locals.
Possibly chase a swan or something.
And slowly piece together the truth.
Now on Backer Kit from Pelgrane Press.
Type Backer Kit and Marysher into your favorite search engine to find the campaign page.
Hello and welcome to Ken and or Robin Talk to Someone Else. And today I, Ken, am at ChupacabraCon in sunny San Marcos, Texas, talking to James Fielder, game designer and game facilitator in a different sort of an environment than a bunch of nerds in a basement somewhere. But first of all, welcome to the program, James. Glad to have you on.
Oh, yeah. Happy to be here. Also go by Pigeon. I'm a political scientist at Colorado State University and also a 25-year military retiree, 5 years enlisted in the Army, 20 commissioned in the Air Force. Have no regrets being in the Army first, but I'd never had a bad day in the Air Force like a bad day in the Army. Yeah. But yeah, as far as I know, I'm one of only two or three political scientists in the discipline who actually researches the politics of game worlds. When people play Dungeons & Dragons, Savage Worlds, Vampire the Masquerade, EVE Online, World of Warcraft, how they players come together to cooperate, build political institutions in games, and how it affects them as players. But from that, I also run professional war games, like running nonprofits, companies, defense units through games and exercises. My most recent being past January 2026, where I ran Adams County, Colorado through a communications crisis. So my journey started in 1996, 1997, when I was a young pup in the Army. Where, you know, I'd gamed growing up, you know, playing, you know, that first edition of Dungeons and Dragons and whatnot. But I wouldn't have considered myself like a remarkable gamer. But to get promoted to sergeant, they said, we need to see if Fielder can deliver a class. And I designed it with role-playing game elements. We, you know, did the classroom instruction, went out in the woods, did an exercise, and everyone said they had a ton of fun. Ton of fun. And I'm like, I didn't exactly know how it worked. and why it worked. But I got that stink on me, and then for the rest of my military career, in addition to my normal duties, I'd be tasked to help arrange training exercises and war games of larger and larger complexity. To date, my largest game that I ever designed and executed was in 2005. Ellsworth Air Force Base, South Dakota, where it was 5,000 participants over 168 hours. So I was in charge of the script, all the exercise evaluators, trainers, gathering all the data, doing the data analysis and the debrief at the end, and preparing the final report for the commander. And then, I've done, since retiring in 2019, I still do work with the Department of Defense. Matter of fact, I'm a U.S. member of the NATO SAS 2019 team. We're putting together an Arctic war game for NATO, and I'm representing the U.S. in Colorado State University. And yeah, it's a ton of fun seeing how what makes a game fun for entertainment purposes has real effect in the classroom and in professional settings as well.
Yeah, leaving aside the sudden revelation that Colorado State University is a member of NATO, which I'm sure everyone's going to be excited to tell other people. I want to get back to that sort of overlap between game design and military exercise that I think is kind of an interesting space to play in. But let's talk briefly about what you were talking about as a political scientist evaluating game worlds. Do you see it, your focus as more on evaluating the political situations that players create for themselves, or the political situation as established in the meta plot or in the game text? Because obviously the political situation as set out in Vampire the Masquerade exists to be deformed and rebelled against and destroyed and exploited by the players in a way that even, most real world political structures aren't. Where would you say your focus is on the sort of the small p politics of the people at the table or the political structure or implications of the world they're playing in?
I would say on balance, I lean towards larger, right. I think larger ramifications of, like, certainly it's going to affect individual players, but seeing like broad swath, like leveraging international relations theory and comparative political theory to see how entire worlds change.
Right. Yeah, that's my academic background, is international relations. I have a degree from the University of Chicago on that. So that's a lot of my world building has been sort of using those structures and those analyses to think what makes the game world fun and ideally realistic at some level. Do you find that fun and realistic are in tension, or do you think that there's a sweet spot where you can build both of those into a game setting?
I'm on the assessment that there has to be some sort of fun element. Certainly for doing an experiment, I want to ensure that the data I'm collecting are, valid. However, if the game isn't fun, players won't develop that illusory attitude where they basically, I'm willing to suspend my disbelief and embed myself into this setting and behave, once in the setting, behave normally within the rules. Without that, basically they could be spoil sports or just never get into it. And then I'm basing all the data I'm collecting at that point are basically flawed.
Right. So you were saying that your academic focus is on politics and game worlds. Is this going to turn into a book? Has it been published papers? Where can people find your conclusions? And is there a Ur conclusion or a Fielder's Law that you want to, or Pigeon's Law that you want to sort of explicate and let the audience fight over later?
Right. Okay. So let's see. Recent works include A Ghost of the Titanomachy, published in Public Math 2022 in Simulation and Gaming, where I studied the Battle of BR5RB in EVE Online. 2020, The Monsters Among Us. It's a contributed chapter to the Politics of Horror, where I examine two live-action Vampire the Masquerade groups using international relations theory. And if you email me, james.fielder@colostate.edu, not Colorado, colostate.edu, I could send you copies of this chapter and this paper. And forthcoming, it should be published in another week or two. I have another short essay coming out in a volume called The Ritual of Play, where I'm basically studying the religious ritual components behind gaming. I also have, in March, I had Beating the Clock, Short Games in the Political Science Classroom. It's a collection of political science games that can be played in 75 minutes or less. And that's co-edited with Derek Glasgow, Ryan Gibb, and Mark Harvey. And we also did, Harvey, Gibb, and Fielder did Games Without Frontiers, Simulations in Political Science Classroom in 2022, where we kind of go in more in the theory and the pedagogical background of why games work in the classroom.
Cool.
But now I'm putting myself on record. I owe a book proposal to Bloomsbury Press by the end of June for a volume tentatively titled The Dungeon Master's Guide to International Politics, where I'm actually going to basically present role-playing games as a playground for studying international relations theory. For example, like in real life, what would a president or a prime minister do if they had a 20th level character, just an adventuring party, just wandering across their territory, that sort of thing.
Right. And I guess it would depend on the president or the prime minister. I feel like Keir Starmer's response and Boris Johnson's response would be different. And we can all extrapolate to our own dear and beloved presidents, if we wish. Yeah. So do you have any sort of native theoretical observation about gaming worlds or gaming groups? Do they tend to realism or towards Theta Scotchpole type institutional play? What do you think the average game world is? Is it a hellish world of Waltzian realism? I suspect it is, probably.
Yeah. Sadly, does lean towards more realism, or basically in a world of anarchy, i.e. no government above, or it's basically every person for themselves, where you need to amass power and do what you can to protect yourself. Now, I will say, leveraging a concept by games studies professor Ian Bogost, who calls it procedural rhetoric, or learning, being persuaded through rules. What that basically means is, if I sit someone down to say, play Dungeons and Dragons, but then take the same setting and run it through Savage Worlds, and take the same setting and run it through, actually probably wouldn't work in Vampire the Masquerade, because of how the rules are designed in each of these settings, it's going to be a subtly, some cases, remarkably different gaming experience because of how the rules are designed. So if I do want to do a study of just pure offensive realism, I could take a probably like Mork Borg or Shadow Dark or Dungeon Call Classics and basically almost encourage the players to take a very selfish, power projecting approach to the adventure. Or I could change it to say, let's do something more heroic. Let's say I like do like a superheroes like Prelates and Paragons or Champions or something like that. And now I'm encouraging them to cooperate to overcome evil, and then to see how they think about power differently now. They want to cooperate and use power altruistically instead.
I have a much repeated anecdote that the reason Warhammer is different from Dungeons and Dragons is that in Europe, when you have armed strangers wandering around in an anarchy, you get the 30 Years War.
Yeah.
And when we have it, it's the Old West. And the difference between a rules-based order like the Old West and a complete offensive realist order like the 30 Years War, I think says a lot about game design. And we could have this conversation for the rest of the time, but I do want to talk about your experience in that liminal space between wargaming and role-playing that is running an exercise. I assume it began with Take That Hill, Blue Team, and then it can be extrapolated all the way out to your North Korea, your South Korea, your China, your Russia, you know, model UN, but with people who aren't teenagers type approaches. I think your experience sort of spans that whole range. And then, as you say, down to, you know, simulated emergency preparation for at the county level or at the city level. Where do you think the productive play comes in those kinds of situations?
All right. So my big rule, like if I say, remember nothing about this conversation, whether it's an entertainment game, a classroom game, or professional game, I always say, start with the objective and work backwards. Like, why are you running this game? And I have to say,
more activity, as Robin would say.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. And everything, you write it up almost like a hypothesis. Like in this game about X, we are going to attempting to do Y, Z, and A. And during the entire design process, by myself, or sometimes I have a team of folks helping me, I'll say anything we write, no matter how cool it sounds, if it does not contribute to that objective, we've got to ruthlessly cut it. Because we want to ensure that once we kick off in a professional setting, well, certainly in an entertainment setting too, but in a professional setting, that we're measuring the correct thing and we're capturing the correct data.
Right. So with the objective defined, then, where do you think the ludic experience comes, because you were talking about getting buy-in to the universe, and I assume that's just as important in a simulation as it is on the tabletop, because if you aren't, you know, in the headspace of North Korea, you're not going to be simulating, you know, the Third World War or whatever accurately. Where do you think that the space is for play in a sort of more formal exercise versus let's all get together in Ravenloft?
Right. So what I do there to encourage an illusory attitude and encouraging folks to get into the what Ken is calling the liminal space, it's also called synthetic experience, magic circle, and presence, is to kind of foster stress, to create an environment that feels unreal for the players. So little things I like to do, like make the room a little warmer, make the room a little colder, have sound effects playing, adjust the lighting. But the piece de resistance, and this never fails to work, is to assign a time limit to everything. That is, like, in the absence of real combat, if I come to a room and say, X is about to happen, you need to stop it, and you only have 10 minutes to come up with a plan, what do you do? And I'm usually shouting at the top of my lungs when I say that. In my head, I might be thinking, it's only going to take them 5 minutes. You watch them, it's like watching their chickens with their heads cut off.
Right. This is where the simulation of prime ministers comes in.
Yeah.
So yeah, all of that is completely actionable at the table, just as it is, you know, in a bunker or a simulation space, which is the great fun thing about this, is that this art form that we practice and create scales so effortlessly and is such a easily understood, do you find, part? I mean, you're saying you've been doing exercises with the Army since the 90s, and obviously military exercises well predate Kriegsspiel. Mm-hmm. I mean, Marius probably ran them for the legions. Practice taking that hill and don't come back until you've done it. Is there any sort of other truth, maybe flipping it around to the player side, the things that you can bring to it to make it a better exercise for you, and that maybe also might apply at the table?
Coming as a player, what I found, players in general, and this is something I can leverage, you're going to have the spoil sports, you're going to have the people who don't want to be there, but the human desire to compete, and also the human desire to not look bad in front of your peers, like, encourages players, it's not perfect, but almost fosters a sense of sportsmanship. Like, they want to do it. Like, they get in, they're willing to participate, and they want to do well. In a professional setting, doing well could have material benefits outside of the game. Certainly, right. If we're grooming somebody for promotion, a exercise is a great place to give them that extra responsibility in an environment where they can take risks. And then, done right, now you can evaluate this individual, like, do we think they might be ready for promotion? But through the act of what's called symbolic correspondence or mythopoesis, that player wearing the mantle of a higher rank in the exercise, it sticks with them and they gain confidence and they come out of it and think, oh, yeah, I do think I'm ready for the next higher rank. So embrace that and actually change a part of you coming out of the game.
So leveling up a thing on every scale of this art form. And like I say, we could talk about this. We could talk about the thesis of international relations in relation to the play space, a great place, but we are running out of time. So I do want you to plug your new Savage World stuff that you've got out. Tell people about it.
Ah, sweet. So in addition to political sciencing at Colorado State, I also work for Mobius Worlds Publishing, a role-playing game publishing company in Littleton, Colorado. Our two games are Prowlers and Paragons and Freedom Squadron. And here at Chupa, I'm running an adventure for Freedom Squadron and an adventure for Prowlers and Paragons. The thing is, the adventure I'm running here for Chupa, Operation Talon's Grasp, is a one-shot adventure, and Freedom Squadron is I should tell you what it is. It's an ode to G.I. Joe setting that uses Savage Worlds rules, and Operation Talon's Grasp should be available for pay what you want on DriveThruRPG after this podcast is uploaded. It's certainly publication ready. And we also have another series called the Hotspot series. And I've already written the first adventure for that, Hotspot Grenada, where I'm having Freedom Squadron going to all these different locations around the world. And although they're not designed to be a complete, like a Savage Tale or Plot Point campaign, they're designed to be used modularly. I will have writing in it to say, hey, if you do want to link these adventures together, and I'm going to do them in blocks of five, you can. I'll give you a way to build it into a plot point campaign.
Fantastic. So if you have ever wanted to play G.I. Joe, but in Savage Worlds, so the lasers kill you, and I guess during the Cold War, even better, then Freedom Squadron's where you want to be, and the author you want to look for is James Fielder. Definitely check out that political science literature that he talked about. I know I will be. Thanks so much, James, for coming on the show. And as is traditional, giving us several segments worth of stuff to talk about, but managing to crush it all into one.
Outstanding. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks again. Play The King in Yellow has haunted imaginations like a dirge since its first appearance in 1895.
But among the fortune tellers of Europe, the play was not the fearful beginning of something new, but the culmination of something older, The King in Yellow Tarot.
Daniel Harms and John Scott Tyne's famous clairvoyants divined the form's importance of this Carcosan deck.
Painter Kurt Komoda, in a fevered fugue of inspiration, reproduced designs thought long lost.
Spread the cards.
Let the King in Yellow tell your fate.
There is no other who could.
After all, you have seen the yellow sign.
The King in Yellow Tarot is a complete deck of 78 cards in full color.
Sturdy cards with a soothing, silky finish.
Inspired by the works of Robert W. Chambers.
An accompanying 28-page guide explores the history of the deck and recommends, hesitantly, its technique.
A complete PDF of cards and guide comes with your order.
Add to cart at shop.arcdream.com.
That's your reality shattered cart at shop.arcdream.com. Ensure that this podcast can still be found by throwing in with such beloved Patreon backers as
James Kiley,
Joshua Randall,
Yuri Horniman,
Kelly Fisher,
and Ryan Mannix.
The woodcuts in the bestiary, the spoor in the dark forest, and the scratching your chin over whether or not Demon has an A, welcome us once more into the Monster Hut, a hut where we address monsters both historically and from a kill'em perspective, or an encounter'em perspective. This is modern gaming. But specifically, beloved Patreon backer Shinanoki asks, I'd be interested in seeing a Monster Hut on the Nymph, a classic of monster manuals and mythology, but which struggles to see use in play. And I think that that is true. And with the big caveat that if you are running a game in which sexual activity is foregrounded or allowed or part of the table contract, much easier to get a Nymph into play. But I think we're going to assume with the majority of tables that we're not doing that stuff on screen, at least maybe, you know, a decorous line of asterisks. But for most, if not all tables, Robin, what do we do with the Nymph?
Right. And so I think the reason that we don't think of the Nymph as a useful monster is that we are thinking of the sort of Victorian painting of the Nymph, the willowy, scantily clad or perhaps unclad young woman cavorting, usually in a brook. I think by the time we get to Victorian paintings, they're mostly river nymphs.
Uh-huh.
But as you'll get to in a moment, nymphs are beings of nature that are sort of divine or semi-divine. They feature in Greek mythology. And I think, as we're about to discover, the way to think about them and get them more monstery and more threatening is to put aside not only that Victorian imagery, but also the Christian assumptions buried in the D&D alignment system, and go back to a more Greek way of thinking, perhaps with a little bit of offstage behavior, and that will get us closer to a nymph that may bear a grudge against you, because it turns out when you go to Greek mythology, there's a bunch of them that are trouble. But Ken, you've gone back to the original source and decided where nymphs come from in the first place.
Yeah, the word comes from nymph or nymphe, which is Greek for ancient Greek for young marriageable woman. That is not usually the context you see it in modern Greek, or bride, which is still how you'll see it in modern Greek. And the cult of the nymphs goes back at least to the 8th century BC, since it's all over Homer. It's in the Odyssey, it's in the Iliad. They mention nymphs all the time. They mention the sacred cave on Ithaca, where the nymph cave where Odysseus hides all of his treasure from Phaeacia. And indeed, they have found such a cave on Ithaca with Mycenaean tripods in it. So, question mark. But anyway, that argues maybe the cult of nymphs is part of what Homer is recalling from Mycenaean times. And some nymph caves do show signs of cult use in Mycenaean times. We just don't know if it was for nymphs. But the archaeological evidence starts turning up definitely by the 7th century BC. You start seeing wooden little sculptures or, in one case, drawings of nymphs left in a nymph cave, and other sorts of offerings, often food offerings. So you see bones there. The nymphs help sanctify and purify marriage rites. They would be invoked sometimes in the marriage, or young girls would go to the nymph cave and offer their childhood toys to the nymphs as a sacrifice to show that they were becoming adult women. And we see little jointed toys in a bunch of nymph caves all over Greece. So we know that that was going on. The cult of Pan gets big in Greece once the cities get big enough that they start romanticizing the outdoors. And so you now start seeing rich yuppies come down to the nymph cave and leave metal and ceramic offerings. And the nymph cult seems to have blown up. At its height is the 4th and 3rd centuries BC. So the Hellenistic era is huge into nymphs because it loves things that can be categorized, and it loves a multiplying local civic ritual. That is, it's a big urban era, and so everyone needs an urban ritual. And what better urban ritual than let's go to our local grove, let's go to the source of our water, let's go to wherever, and let's give it a cool name, and then move on. So a nymph is somewhere between a goddess and a mortal, less than a goddess, more than a mortal. There's a lengthy debate in classical times about, are nymphs immortal? Specifically, do dryads outlive their trees? Big question. And people will adduce different myths for different versions of that, both then and now. And often if you need to explain where a hero or a powerful figure came from, oh, well, their mother was a nymph. So they get inserted into genealogies, both of heroes and of founders of cities. So the founder of your city may have been in the record, but you don't know who their mom was. So probably a nymph. And Ares and Harmonia, for example, make the Amazons. And so Harmonia is a nymph, and her job there is to make Amazons and not do a lot else. Other nymphs, like Calypso and Thetis from Homer, they are practically heroes. They have agency. They have action. They yell at gods. They get busy getting their son really cool armor, you know, whatever it is. And that gives you a sort of a guardian demigod for a hero, if the hero already in the story doesn't have one, or is all the gods are mad at them, as with Odysseus. And some nymphs are just, well, they're a god, they probably have nymphs with them. So Poseidon and his wife Amphitrite have the Nereids. Dionysus has the Maenads. Those are nymphs. Hecate has the Lampads, who follow Hecate with torches, which is kind of a cool and dangerous thing. You got a torch wielding nymph.
All of these three are scary gods. So yeah. It's not going to be hard for us to make nymphs scary if they work for Poseidon or Dionysus or Hecate.
Yeah. And so by the classical era, nymphs have become the personifications of a welcoming place. They're the spirit of the place. A meadow. Meadow nymphs are limonids. A tree. Those are dryads, although some people say those are just oak nymphs. A grove. That would be an alcyid, is a nymph of a grove. Pygaea are the nymph of a spring. A river is the naiad, the famous river nymph. And naiad is, again, that term, like dryad, spreads to any freshwater, so you can have rain naiads even. And then mountains or caves, the oreads. So those are your many, many types of nymphs. And as I say, the Hellenistic authors went insane coming up with super specialized nymphs. So there's bee nymphs, for example.
Yeah, it's like they had many monster manuals to produce.
Exactly. So they did. There's a whole tradition of guys that just would sort of write down the bare bones version of all these stories and genealogies and myths. And then real chroniclers like Herodotus would roll their eyes and say, "Ah, this is just crunch. We need more fluff." So all that said, the Oceanids and the Nereids show up very early in the record. So personification of nature maybe comes before personification of pleasant nature, and personification of local pure or fresh water source is maybe the very earliest version of this, because the first depictions that we have of nymphs are all naiads, and they're on coins and vases. And this is, again, late archaic, so 6th century, 7th century yes. BC.
So, you need water to survive more than you need oak trees. So they're exactly. earlier on that in the hierarchy.
Nymphs do love oak trees. They also love ash trees, and then plane and laurel and apple and poplar. And you would think there'd be a lot of nymphs in water trees, but I don't think there's a willow nymph, or if there is, I didn't find it. And then some nymphs are just part of the sky. The Pleiades, they were buddies of Artemis. The Hyades, these are the nymphs that were very, very sad when they accidentally drowned Hylas, pulling him under the brook. And so their tears.
And of course, the Hyades play a big role in the Yellow King mythology. So they, yep. those nymphs are bad news. We know that.
They are. And the Hesperides, which are the nymphs associated with Venus, the morning star, and they're the nymphs of the western sky. So that's why you have the islands of the Hesperides. That's where those nymphs live. That's where Venus touches down in the west. And then what nymphs can do, they can do sort of semi-divine magics. They do healing sometimes. They shapeshift. But their best thing that they do is that they inspire nympholepsy, which means you've been struck by a nymph. You're nymph shot. And even Socrates is worried that when they went out, they did a little symposium. It was a nice day. They went to a pleasant grove, and Socrates says, "I don't know if this is going to be a good lesson. I'm feeling nympholeptic right now."
Right.
"And I'm going to talk in poetry instead of wisdom."
Right. We might accidentally see a girl, and it will ruin all of our concentration.
It will ruin everything, especially yeah. for Plato.
And so that's a case where the nymph can be perfectly benign, except so magically powerful that she messes you up anyway. So, and yeah. that's a problem, because you don't cut her down with an axe. She's just... It's on you that you've gone nymph mad. So you've got to figure out some other way of countering the fact that you failed your resist nymph role.
And then there's a tradition. It's multiple places. You'll see like a local lord or king, and he goes out of his way to build shrines to the nymphs around all the fountains and caves in his area. And they all said, "Oh, he's nympholeptic. He's been nymph struck. That's what happened to him." And obviously sexual obsession, big thing that happens when you see a nymph, or just plain old madness. And I think this maybe is that cult of Pan that I talked about. If Pan brings nymphs with him and he brings madness, then nymphs bring madness. So it's a sort of a, you know, epidemiology of madness more than it is something just about the nymphs, but you can't rule it out because it is in the sources. And if you act crudely to a nymph, you make a proposition she doesn't want to hear, or if you cheat on them, they'll send a bee to sting you. And the implication is in a place you do not want to be stung. If you are super handsome, the nymph may just fall in love with you and drag you under the water. And let's just say that she does not forget to let you breathe underwater so that you can be her nymph kept man for a while, but maybe right. you just drown.
And if you do, you know, have a meaningful relationship with the nymph, and you step out on her, she will blind you as Nomia does to Daphnis.
And you don't want that.
Yeah, as happens in some stories, she kills Daphnis. Even worse, the vain and idle nymph Salmacus, which tells us that there are, you know, good nymphs and bad nymphs.
Like with everybody.
Yeah, like with everybody. She's rejected by Hermaphroditus. And in a moment of early body horror in mythology, she fuses with him to become a hybrid entity. So you definitely don't, whatever your interest in nymph is, you don't want them fusing with you and becoming half of what you were and half them. That's not a good situation
at
all.
That's not good. And Hermaphroditus, by the way, has no sense of humor about this. He asks his father Hermes to curse the spring of the nymph so that everyone who drinks from it suffers the same fate. So that's not good. and then don't want to chop down a dryad's tree or she will curse you, often with eternal hunger. And the stories sort of say, well, first he ate all the food in his house, then he ate all the animals in his house, then he ate all of his kids, then he ate himself. The end. Don't mess with a nymph's tree.
Right. You also don't want to tell Nereids that your daughter Andromeda is more beautiful than them, because then 50 of them will band together, petition Poseidon to send a sea monster to eat Andromeda as a sacrifice. So whether you're Cassiopeia or you have some other beautiful daughter, do not engage in that sort of hubris. So that's another reason that nymphs can be trouble. And you, the adventurers, can come in, you know, after some other fool has offended them, and then they're coming with the sea monster to your city. Well, you got to deal both with the sea monster and with them. The most famous dangerous nymphs, though, are the sirens. They're nymphs. They're sea nymphs. They're now menacing Matt Damon at an IMAX near you. Very famous. They have a sonic attack. They have a hypnotizing attack. They're pretty clearly already scary. We don't have to do much with them. My favorite version of sirens, of course, is in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? But they're already trouble. We don't have to go any further into that. And also another reason nymphs may use their abundant panoply of powers is just that they've been cruelly punished by a god and are looking to take it out on someone else who they can get back at, i.e. not a god, i.e. possibly you, the adventurer. So, for example, Hera curses Echo, and her offense was just that she was very talkative. And so she blathered so much that Hera was not able to keep the sort of tabs on Zeus that she needed to all of the time, and he went off dallying, and therefore she got mad at the wrong person. She got mad at Echo, and therefore cursed her to only be able to say whatever the last person she was talking to said, therefore echoing their words. Or Artemis victim blames Callisto when Zeus forces himself on her and turns her into a bear. So you could encounter all sorts of nymphs in dangerous animal form as well. And I think Callisto has a lot of anger to work out. And again, might not be too fussy since she can't exactly kill Artemis. If you're perhaps wearing the badge of Artemis or just look vaguely Artemis-y,
she's carrying a bow.
going to come at you in bear form.
I don't want a lot of well actuallys from the audience. Sirens, there is two schools of thought. One is that, as you say, they're Nereids or Oceanids who have a special purpose in life. Others, that they're a different kind of being that then gets artistically conflated with nymphs by the Hellenistic era. So sirens, we could maybe do a whole different hut on the sirens, but it is a possibility that if you are a nymph, you get given a special task by Poseidon or whoever, and then you're stuck with that, and it probably puts you in a bad mood anyway. And speaking of the legends changing over time, they still see nymphs in modern rural Greece. Now that they're all Christian, they know that the nymphs are demons or demonically powered. They are now generally called Nereidae, like Nereid, and their dangers are more part of the story. So nympholepsy is not just a fun poetic enthusiasm. It's sunstroke or a regular stroke or something else very bad. They drown children instead of just hot guys. They're worse, basically. The Nereidae are worse than the old classical nymphs were. And so they're more similar, ironically, to the fairies of Northern European lore. And the question is, does everywhere with brooks and trees and caves and grottos have a nymph equivalent, and we just call them, you know, fairies or Rusalki or Leshy or whatever we call our fairies locally? So are nymphs special to Greece, or are they a global thing that nymph is just a specific name of, and because Homer wrote about them, they're our favorite?
So that's lots of ways to make the nymph more than just a comely cavorting being, but rather an active danger to the adventurers as they're tromping through whatever sacred grove or oak-lined lane, or especially near any body of water, can wind up in trouble from them. And so I think we've restored their status as monsters that you have to deal with, possibly fight, possibly counter with magic, or maybe negotiate your way out of. But we've got some nymphs in the monster hut, and therefore, having fulfilled the task assigned us by a beloved Patreon backer, can move to another hut.
The British are coming!
The Kickstarter campaign is almost upon us for Flag Bearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Thoroughly researched and beautifully illustrated, in Nations and Cannons you play as spies, skirmishers, and saboteurs in the battle for the future of the 13 colonies.
The next book, The American Crisis, Dark and Bloody Ground, follows the actions of the war in the South and the West with historical adventures, setting information, perfidious new enemies, and a sprawling campaign.
The Kickstarter campaign also features a revised core book supporting play in other eras, a supplement about political scheming within the two sides of the war, and years of maps, supplements, splat books, and adventures following the war from Boston to Yorktown.
Nations and Cannons is 5e compatible and focuses on unconventional heroes from underrepresented perspectives.
This Kickstarter is the best time ever to get into Nations and Cannons.
Sign up to be notified of the Kickstarter campaign at yourdadwilllovethis.com. It's time once more to wander into that most ill-defined of huts, the one where crankery meets strangeness, where we're not really sure what's going on until we look out the window and see the alien big cat screaming on the moor. And over in the corner, there are the Nordic alien and the gray alien, and they're kind of tuning out over their kombucha because we're going to go and talk about a vampire. But this is a historically attested vampire from the days when people believed in revenants coming back from the grave, and surprisingly recently in this case, because we're going to talk about an early 18th century example, this is the Vampire Rampage of Mikhail Kasparek. And I found this in a new book called Killing the Dead by John Blair, which traces the evolution and movement of vampire lore, culminating in the heavy fictionalization of that by Bram Stoker. And you saw my review and you picked up a copy as well.
Yep.
And so you were able to go back and look into these very specific facts of a very recent vampire rampage.
And for people who want to replicate my feat, if you want to read about this in English, Killing the Dead by John Blair is your only source. All the other sources are in Hungarian. So either your Google Translate foo has got to be on point, or get your own copy of Killing the Dead. You will not regret it. But our story takes place in the town of Lublo, which is now Stara Lubovna. It was once medieval Hungary, and then the king of Hungary got short of money, and so he leased it to Poland. And at the time of our story, it's in southern Poland. 7 tons of silver. That's how much it costs you to buy Lublo from the king of Hungary. And it is now northern Slovakia, because the people who came along later didn't care who had rented what from who and just put it in Slovakia. So there we are. But we are in February 1718, February 28th, according to the record. And these sources, by the way, are all contemporary town records. They're reports from the neighboring Hungarian county, the county of Liptov, where one assumes the count said, people are going crazy over in rented Poland. What's going on with that?
This is better documented than a lot of incidents of the period not involving vampire rampages.
Right, of regular, actual historical things. And the town doctor, a Dr. Buchholz, because there's a German population, especially within the town, he wrote his memoirs and he said, my dad had to deal with this vampire. And so that's the story. So our, I don't know if he's a protagonist, but whatever he is, he's a wine merchant. His name is Mikhail Kasparek. And so this is one of the cases.
I'm going to say he's an anti-hero at best.
Okay, at best. And this is one of the cases where you've got a vampire of the middle, or dare I say upper classes. Most vampires, historically anyway, are sort of peasant schlubs. But this guy, he's doing all right. He dies in Lublo. He's buried. And he immediately leaves his grave and rides around town on a white horse. And normally vampires don't like white horses, but apparently everything's different if you're rich. He's dressed in red finery, and he bangs on doors. He busts in on parties. People are trying to get married, and he shows up and says, hey, who's got blood for Mikhail Kasparek? And he would attack people in their beds. There's lots of reports of waking up and feeling a cold presence pushing down on you in bed, biting and tugging at you, biting you especially on your arms and neck. And then the other thing that a 18th century or conventional Balkan vampire does is they get everybody pregnant. And so he impregnated his widow and four of, one assumes, his housemaids, but maybe other people's housemaids. I suppose this was the get out of jail free if you were an area housemaid. You say, oh, that was the vampire did it. I'm sorry. So on March 26th, they have a town meeting about all this, and they have two uniate priests, and uniate is Greek Catholic. And again, the town is basically split between the Roman Catholics and the Greek Catholics. And Greek doesn't mean that they're Greeks. It means it's the Greek rite. So they're Slovaks, probably. Anyway, they try an exorcism, but it doesn't take. By April 15th, he's still roaming around. He's knocked down a man and pulled out his beard, which, again, that seems more like just being a jerk than being a vampire. But I guess that's what happens.
But it's often the case, in fact, that there's a whole bunch of other stories like this. This is just one of the more vividly detailed ones. And it's often the case that the vampire is not a lord up on the hill, first of all. He's one of your neighbors, mm-hmm. and he's a neighbor who often, although not always, was a big jerk in life. Uh-huh. And the suggestion sort of is that he's such a jerk that he doesn't move on.
Right.
Now, there's also examples of people who were perfectly virtuous in life, but there was some sort of error in the burial rite or some other thing, or they died in such
a... They let a cat jump over the corpse. That's always the thing that happens.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The cat over the corpse. That's a big problem. But there's also this theme of, you know, the neighborhood bully who just keeps coming back to the neighborhood even after you've buried him.
Very Stephen King in a way. So they open Casper X's grave finally. And this, by the way, this is remarkable patience on the part of the villagers. You imagine a party of player characters is like doing that in March the 3rd or something. But they finally open the grave. They find Casper X. He's there. He's ruddy and bloated, grinning at them. Blood is on his clothing. There's torn hair in his fists. So the beard story checks out. And they're like, well, what do we do about this? The local Catholic priest writes to the Bishop of Krakow for permission to exhume the body. And we have that letter in the records of the town of Krakow. So,
and that's why they waited. It was a big legal, or at least ecclesiastical legal deal to dig somebody up. It was not acceptable. So, you know, it's like, which taboo are we going to break when we're dealing with this vampire?
And in the letter, they do say, other area priests have often dug up the corpses of vampires and it worked great. So just saying.
Yeah, but so there's already an informal rogue, but could you write your name on this?
We just like permission here in rented Poland. We're in legal trouble. So the bishop, you know, what a guy, completely proactive. Return of post grants permission April 24th. So on the 26th, they reopen the grave. They take out the body. They cut out his heart and they put it in a box. First, they bury the box under a dunghill. And then the family is like, really? They, all right. So we'll give you the heart back. Then they behead the body. They burn head and body at the boundary of the town. And while they've burned him, his right foot and then his left foot raises and lowers in the fire. And also his body makes frog noises, which I don't know that that is very common in vampire lore. I'm going to go on a limb and say frog noises is, again, just part of the Michael Kasparic special.
Right. But that's what lends it this air of documentary reality, right? Is that it's got weird details in it. It's not all totally what you would expect.
And at no point would you put that in to make people believe in vampires more. You'd say, ah, but did you know they make frog noises? And it's, I'm out.
Yeah.
I'm out.
Yeah.
But guess what? It doesn't take. MK is back. Kasparek is back. He's back on his horse. He's back in his dandy clothes. He sasses a nobleman. And at this point, you begin to think that this is someone who's also got a grudge against the nobleman, saying, did you hear that he got sassed by Michael Kasparek? What a jerk that guy is, calling that nobleman an idiot and telling him to get out of his way or he'll shove him down. That's no way to be. I would never say that to a nobleman like that guy, who should be shoved down by a vampire. In May, he goes to Warsaw to collect some money that is owed him. And I love this. This is part of the story. He just disappears from the record for 3 weeks. I don't know that anyone has gone to Warsaw and looked around in 1718 to see if a guy on a white horse is running around yanking beards and stealing money. But I love the notion of the vampire's like, damn it, time to collect my mortgage money or whatever. So he returns, though, by the end of May. And now he's mad. He's got a big mad on because they burned his body, and he starts burning down Ludlow. He burns house after house, building after building, and people can do nothing. They try another exorcism, this time with Roman Catholic priests, or monks, rather.
Right. That's the advantage of having two kinds of priests. You can,
right.
You know, if one fails, you bring in the other.
And he then says, stop trying to exorcise me. You know that doesn't work. And just for that, I'm going to burn down the church and the town hall, and it'll be on July 8th. So everyone get together.
This guy's just incredible bad news. It's like, it is genuinely a huge rampage that, like, not only kills a bunch of people, he gets their beards ripped out, but he levels a good chunk of the town.
Yeah. And, you know, people are, like, living in the town square because their houses have been burned out. It's just insane. But finally, someone, possibly a player character, remembers, hey, isn't his heart still around? And they go to Kasparic's family. They've been going back to Kasparic's family this whole time saying, are you sure he never studied sorcery? And they're like, look, if he'd studied sorcery, we would tell you by now. Feel free, go through everything.
Yeah, he would still have all those books that we got rid of.
Right. And so they go back to the Kasparic family and they say, give us the heart. And one assumes that if they don't give them the heart is still taken. And then they take the heart out to the boundary and they burn it there. And thank goodness, Robin, that does it. He was the kind of vampire like the Murini that lives in the heart, not in the whole body and head. So, but they, right. They took care of that. Problem is over. Ludlow is still in smoldering ruins, but at least they don't have Michael Kasparic riding around on his white horse sassing people. So
right.
There we are, a victory for reason and rationality at the beginning of the Enlightenment.
Right. So to make this work for player characters, the heart is going to have to have been relocated another time, right? You can't right. just go to, first of all, the player characters are there when the decision is made to put the heart in a box and save it. They're going to stop that. So you got to make sure that they're not around for that scene. And then when they go to the family, it's like, well, we did take it, but then, I don't know, Michael came back and took the heart away from us and buried it somewhere so that you have to, mm-hmm. you know, have your proper final confrontation.
Or they open the heart box and it's gone, or there's some guy's beard in it or something.
Exactly. So normally we'd spend some time turning things into a scenario, but with that addition, with that little amendment, it's already a scenario. Our work is done here.
And you can compress it if you feel like your player characters will be more proactive and less concerned with the opinion of the Bishop of Krakow, but it's a good vampire rampage, and it has everything, beard yanking, housemaid endangering, the whole gamut of story is there.
Right. I guess you could do a modern thing where the box that the heart was kept in still maintains some sort of power. So in Knight's Black Agents or somewhere else, you could just take somebody else's, a treasured agent's heart goes in that box for a little while, and then they come back as a super vampire. And as vampires often do, perhaps forgets to follow instructions from that point on, and you, the burned agents, now have to deal with them. So you could also do a sequel that calls back to Michael Kasparic, or, you know, maybe there's a ritual or summoning that he's pretty intent on coming back. Maybe he comes back yet again. Maybe you contact him in the world beyond and tell him you've discovered a debt that he's still owed that he'll come back for.
And don't sleep on those 3 weeks in Warsaw. That's when he could have been setting up his, you know, I'm going to come back plan. And, you know, he's a wine merchant, so maybe he puts his vampire blood into wine bottles and stores them somewhere, and then they turn up. I will point out that beloved black magic author Dennis Wheatley was a wine merchant. So if you want him to show up in Trail of Cthulhu and you want to meet Dennis Wheatley, he's bought a load of wine from Poland from an old estate in the Wildy Woods outside Warsaw. And sure enough, there's vampire goo in the wine, and Michael Kasparic is back and rattling around London and having a grand old time and getting ready to burn it down.
So everybody, remember, if you're dealing with a vampire, don't just save the heart for sentimental reasons. It's a pretty crucial component. You'll want to get rid of that as well. And having dispensed that important one weird trick about dealing with rampaging pre-Stoker vampires, we can now congratulate ourselves on a job well done yet another week, and get ready for another job a week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Semple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/CanAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from nymph bamboozlement alongside such backers as
Scott Jones,
The Molten Sulfur Blog,
Ariel Celeste,
Ginge,
and Jeffrey Pittman.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Jomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when once again, we will talk about stuff.